KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Madhavi Sundar of UC Davis School of Law, author of the new book, From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice. Intellectual property is a major focus of Hearsay Culture, going back to its inception over 6 years ago. And occasionally we've had an opportunity to discuss alternative ways to view the purpose behind intellectual property law. Why is it that we have these laws that are designed theoretically to encourage creation, or more specifically, what should the law be doing to encourage people to engage in creating, as the U.S. Constitution calls it, science and the useful arts? And in From Goods to a Good Life, Madhavi posits that intellectual property law itself has perhaps been too cabined in its views and perspectives towards why and how people create. And the traditional theory behind, at least in the U.S., intellectual property law is a utilitarian model, the model that says that we need to incentivize the creation of useful arts and science, and we do that by giving inventors and giving authors a monopoly for a period of time over a piece of work, or just giving them simply the ability to make money off of what they create. And in that way, the theory says, people will create more and will have more cultural production. But that doesn't and is not the only way to conceive, or the only reason behind, intellectual property law. And so in From Goods to a Good Life, Madhavi goes in a slightly different direction, focusing on the impact of intellectual property law on social and cultural life and social and cultural norms in creating works of authorship. So rather than thinking about intellectual property law purely from an economic perspective, Madhavi in her book takes a look at intellectual property law more broadly and outside the United States towards other communities that have not traditionally been the focus of the theory behind IP. What do we do in cultures where intellectual property law is not not conceived in a utilitarian way, or in fact where it doesn't exist in a codified form, and how do we encourage those communities and those individuals to engage in the same kind of useful production that we seek to encourage in the traditional economic sense through the utilitarian model? And so in the book, Madhavi takes a look at these issues through a variety of lenses, heavily from a theoretical perspective, but also from a practical perspective, to figure out a way to implement such a system, and more particularly think about how to conceive it. And so our discussion today is going to be getting into what Madhavi calls a third theory of culture, and we're going to spend a good amount of time on that, as well as critiquing the theories, particularly the utilitarian model, that has underlied IP law in the United States and is the focus, for better or for worse, of IP law continually and as it exists today. So I'm very excited to have Madhavi on. I've had on a number of her colleagues from Davis, and I've enjoyed having all of them on the show, and I'm excited to have Madhavi on today. She's a professor of law at UC Davis. She was named in 2006 as a Carnegie Scholar. She's taught at Yale and the University of Chicago, and she's a prolific author who's published in a number of law reviews. I'm very excited to have her on today. She is joining us from her home in Davis, California via Skype. Madhavi, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks a lot, Dave. It's great to be on the show. Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. Let's start off with a basic question I ask most of my authors. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you wrote From Goods to a Good Life.
Okay. Well, I've been teaching intellectual property and writing scholarship in this field for over a decade, but I also come from teaching property law and thinking a lot about property scholarship, and it struck me that toward the end of the last century, we witnessed this social enlightenment, as it's been called, in property law, where theorists like Peggy Radin, Tom Gray, Joseph Singer, really recognized that that we had a pretty narrow approach to thinking about property law as about efficiency alone, when in fact property rights, our right to own our home, affects so many more fundamental values, from freedom, freedom from government, freedom to express ourselves, to personhood. This is a property is about roots and stability and personality, to equality as well, and democracy. So we understand that in a thriving democracy, we need to have dispersal of property ownership. So there are so many, even rights to health, rights to speech are affected by property ownership. And this is something that most American scholars today would recognize, that there are plural values at stake when we think about property. But when I began teaching intellectual property in the United States, especially at the turn of the century, we started to hear many pundits say intellectual property has come of age. We all know, of course, it's extremely important to the American economy and increasingly to the global economy. But despite this claim that the IP law has come of age, we had a very narrow way of thinking about intellectual property. So in the United States, IP rights are considered exclusively from the paradigm of incentives. The idea is that we need intellectual property rights to promote public goods like literature, music. These are things that the whole world can enjoy without diminishing the quality of the good, of the music or of the knowledge or the literature. But the problem is simply one of incentives, because who's going to have the incentive to create these fine works if we can't, if they can't profit from them, if it's too easy for others to copy without paying. So the incentives has arisen as the basically raison d'etre for why we have intellectual property rights at all. And I think something that you said in the introductory comments that you made was that then this has made our IP law focus on the production of more, right? We have just enough IP protection in the case of patents for inventions or copyrights for expressive works to produce more goods. So what's the optimal amount of iPods and R2-D2s that we can produce? So we're focusing on producing more goods, but I critique that, you know, that has left a bunch of fundamental questions unasked. So, you know, well, why should we only be concerned about more? What about what are we producing? What kind of goods get produced under this model, and what doesn't get produced? There's the fundamental question of access. So even when we're producing goods, who can actually access them in the marketplace? And finally, who gets to make these goods? Is it enough to say, well, as long as some multinational corporations are making all the goods, does that satisfy us from the perspective of participatory culture and from the perspective of distributive justice? So there are these fundamental questions that I felt were getting unasked, and fundamental values that are absolutely implicated in the realm of cultural production. Just as I mentioned, freedom and equality and democracy are implicated in the context of real property, land ownership. They're certainly implicated in the realm of cultural production and exchange, but these were values and questions that I felt were not being asked sufficiently, and so that's why I wrote this book, to highlight these important issues and the connections between culture and human freedom, not just culture and innovation.
Yeah, it's an interesting critique, and one that we're going to get to in more detail, because it certainly is reminiscent of the critiques made of movements like law and economics that conceive of human beings acting only in certain ways without consideration of others. And we're going to get to those points in a moment as we dive more into your theory. But you tell a story in the book which I think is of particular relevance not only to the listeners but also to understanding your reason for doing this book. And you tell an anecdote about your grandmother and how it influenced you. And perhaps you could get into that here. Tell us a bit about that story.
Okay, great. Well, my grandmother was born in the early 1900s in India, and she was the youngest of five sisters. All four of her older sisters were married in their teens, and they did not receive any kind of higher education. But my grandmother, by the time she was coming of age, her father recognized that times were changing. The culture in India was changing, and he thought that she could go to university, and she went to study. She went to college in Madras, and then she eventually went to Banaras Hindu University, which is often called the Harvard of India, and where she got a master's in physics. While she was in college, she was a tennis champion. She was president of her college class, and she went on to break even more barriers of her time. She when everybody around her was acquiescing to arranged marriages, my grandmother fell in love with my grandfather and married him, despite all of the opprobrium that was sent their way. Mm-hmm. And so the story inspired me. I think, you know, I mentioned that she got a master's in physics. She became a physics professor. But I guess I want to emphasize that I didn't find my inspiration in her story because she was the inventor of things as a scientist, but rather because she was the inventor of her own life. And her story has always been emblematic of what culture is. Culture isn't just a set of givens, traditions, commodities that are handed down to us that we just have to take or, you know, or leave. But rather, culture is something we create and invent ourselves. We are living in a culture, we're immersed in culture, but it doesn't fully define us. We are the autonomous beings that act back, speak back to, push boundaries within our culture. And so I think it's a really important story to illuminate what is culture. It's not goods. It's not static commodities, but it's a participatory act of individuals and communities together to make new meaning in the world, to make a greater meaning out of their own lives. And so I think that there's importance there to understanding the relationship between culture and intellectual property too, which I can elaborate on more. But I critique this view of intellectual property as just, again, thinking about the cultural sphere that it regulates as the regulation of goods. It's really about regulating a sphere in which we create our lives and change our communities.
We're chatting with Professor Madhavi Sundar of UC Davis School of Law, author of the book From Goods to a Good Life on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Madhavi, I do want to get into that critique because you spent a good amount of time on it in the book, and I think it's important in understanding the thesis that you propose here. So I will ask that very doctoral type question.
Sure.
What is your thesis, and in particular, what is your, as you call it, third theory of culture?
Okay. So I critique, first of all, I remark that so much wonderful intellectual property scholarship that has truly inspired me and my own work that actually determined, you know, my choice of going into this field, has surprisingly ignored cultural theory. So intellectual property's raison d'etre is the promotion of culture and knowledge. And yet it's largely been informed from one discipline outside of law, and that's the discipline of economics. And even there, it's been a narrow strain of law and economics that has influenced IP law and policy, as opposed to even broader theories of economics like developmental economics, for example. So I was struck by the lack of attention to fields like cultural studies, anthropology, the anthropologists who study culture and what is culture. When we talk about music and literature, there's fields like performance theory, musicology, all of these really rich interdisciplinary disciplines that can help us better understand what culture is. And so that's really one of my first tasks in the book, is to elaborate three different theories of culture that have been identified, particularly in fields like cultural studies. And so the first two theories are the theory of culture as tradition or culture as commodity. So the culture as tradition view sees culture kind of like in the context of how I was describing with my grandmother. A culture as tradition person would say culture is just something. It's the norms and values that music and art that surrounds you, and you just have to imbibe that culture, learn the tradition rotely. So that's one view of culture, and I argue that this has actually been rejected. This view has long been rejected by modern cultural theorists and anthropologists. And yet at the same time, I say that there are strains of it in IP, and I can come back to that in a minute. The other theory of culture that I consider is the idea of culture as commodity. And this, of course, has more resonance in the IP field, where we're talking about, creating and incentivizing the production of goods that are going to be sold in markets like iPods, et cetera. And the commodity view I turn to the work of Jürgen Habermas, in particular his highly influential early work, The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, where he beautifully describes the rise of commodity culture. And this is toward the late 19th century, then 20th century, the idea that the production of knowledgeable goods, books, even the production of lectures by professors for consumption by an emerging middle class, a leisure class, and how this transformed the notion the importance of commodities, but the connection between commodities and enlightenment itself. Mm-hmm. So he talks about how enlightened people buy knowledge goods. Enlightenment came to focus on access to goods. Today we talk about a concept that's popular in global social movements, the concept of access to knowledge. But I would argue that the way Habermas describes the notion of access to knowledge came to mean access to learned works, buying the encyclopedia that would just give you information. And so this is the commodity view of culture. And I critique both the view of culture as tradition and culture as commodity, and argue instead for a view of participation, culture as a participatory community instead. That's my third view of culture that I think is both better descriptively in terms of describing how people actually make their way through the world, engaging with the culture around them, because I argue that we don't just rotely mimic the traditions, and that's where my grandmother story comes in. We actually re-engage them, we critique them, we broaden them, we change them. So I argue that that's in fact how we do act in culture, not in in the way of the tradition view, but in this participatory view. And I argue from a normative perspective that a view of culture as participatory community is actually more in line with true enlightenment values than is the commodity view, for example, or the tradition view. So let me elaborate there again, turning back to Habermas, if I could.
Yes.
For a minute.
Sure.
So in the structural transformation of the public sphere, Habermas talks about how that particular view of viewing goods, knowledge goods, as the end of enlightenment wasn't always the way we thought about enlightenment. If you go back to, in fact, the age of enlightenment, the birth of enlightenment in the late 18th century and in the early 19th century, the age of the thriving salons and coffee houses where the ordinary people would come together and, well, let's be honest, not necessarily ordinary people, the elite. The elite of society would come together, but they would debate. They would debate the books. They would debate the politics. They would debate culture. And Habermas talks about this view of enlightenment as being fundamentally participatory, where everyone can be involved, everyone has a say, and there are no givens that are taken or just passively imbibed. And I argue that, in fact, we're seeing, again, an age of participatory culture, obviously with new technologies, the internet, blogging, YouTube, and rip, mix, and burn technologies. We're, again, moving to this time where the book is not the end, but the means to more creativity, more discussion, and critical thinking. And so that's where my view of culture as participatory community comes in. I think it's normatively a better view to promote the kinds of goals that we have in a democratic society and in an enlightened society. We care about fostering critical thinking and engagement. We care about fostering freedom to think itself, right? So we don't want to just imbibe culture as it's given to us, take it or leave it culture that we saw in the last century, where commodities are just handed down to us, but we want to be able to push back, talk back, express ourselves through culture. So I think normatively too, this the idea of participation is one that promotes critical thought as opposed to passive reception. It's against the notions that we see in more traditional societies as opposed to enlightened societies. And of course, there's an important democratic element. The goal would be to get, unlike the enlightenment of the late 18th century, the enlightenment of this century should also focus on broadening that base of who can participate in culture, ordinary people, minorities, people from the developing world, indigenous people, women, girls, etc. So and sexual minorities. So I'm very much focused on broadening who gets to participate too, and the benefits of that.
And I think that what you just said gets to, as you were speaking, and I'm looking at the cover of the book. I note not only your subtitle, Intellectual Property and Global Justice, to which I think you were just referring, the cover of the book has a picture of a family sitting around, and children as well as grandparents or older relatives sitting around a plate of food, and it gets to this idea that I do want to ask you about, and ask you about from a slightly different perspective. In thinking about these issues, and particularly your critique of utilitarianism, perhaps I'll ask you to kind of elaborate a little bit more on what you just said. What kinds of goods are not being produced, in your view, or not being produced I don't even want to use their optimal, not being produced in ways that will be culturally beneficial? You mentioned, I think, some of the who's, but perhaps you could talk a little bit more about the what's.
Sure,
what's missing?
Sure, great. I'm so glad you gave me this opportunity to come back to that. So, for example, what's not getting produced under the current model? An important example is medicines. And right now we have a market-driven patent system. So we think, okay, you need patents to incentivize, but you also need a market of people who will want to buy a good to incentivize production. And that has led to the production of drugs for balding and erectile dysfunction. And yet we still have no drugs that would treat the diseases that afflict millions of poor people, such as malaria and tuberculosis. And the reason for this lacuna is that these people are too poor to pay for the drugs. There is no market here. So we have this whole range of neglected diseases and no medicines there. So this is a hole in the incentive theory of patents, the idea that patents will always promote socially beneficial drugs, but we've seen that's just not the case, and that's because the patent system as it currently stands is driven much by markets. Now you brought up the cover, and another point that I make too is another problem with the incentive theory is that these incentives will only work when a society actually has the capacity to innovate. Mm-hmm. So in the developing world, in poor societies, there is very little investment in research institutions, in R&D, there is low technical capacity. But at the same time, under the current international patent laws, all of these countries, even the poorest countries in the world, are supposed to recognize 20-year patents in all areas of invention, and that rule really only benefits foreigners. It protects the patents of foreign companies in those poor countries, but it doesn't do anything at all to incentivize innovation in those poor countries because they don't have the capacity to innovate. So those are a couple examples where we have problems, and I actually argue that we need to focus on improving the capacity of the poor to innovate. But that's important because we want, as I mentioned, democratic participation. We want even the poor to have the ability to create music, to create scientific innovation that can be shared with the world.
We're chatting with Professor Madhavi Sunder of UC Davis on Hearsay Culture and KZCFM Stanford. Madhavi, let me ask you one more question before we take a short break. Getting to that idea, and let me push back a little bit, because I can imagine defenders of the utilitarian model saying, well, of course, we want to encourage everyone to create, because if our system means that that person, that entity, will have the ability to make some money, and isn't that something which is the primary incentive for people to engage in creation? So the pushback position would be, doesn't the utilitarian system already encompass these ideas of encouraging as many people as possible to produce?
Great question, and also it allows me to clarify that I'm not against the utilitarian analysis of intellectual property.
Okay.
I think it's really important. I think it does a lot, both descriptively and normatively, to cabin intellectual property rights as well. But the main point that I'm making is that it's not enough to explain the full range of what's going, of the values that are at stake and what's going on in cultural production and exchange. But on your point about the importance of making money from what we produce and create, I'm very in favor of understanding that IP rights, one important role that they serve is that they enable creators to have livelihood. And this is extremely important in the developing world context as well. So we live in a knowledge age. The production of knowledge goods is what drives our global economy. If a poor country cannot create and participate in that knowledge production economy, they are going to fall even further behind. So I argue that we do need to actually focus on helping poor people develop their knowledge of the law, develop their production skills, develop their technical capacity to participate in these global markets, because money matters. But at the same time, I reject the idea that the only reason we create is to make money. Money is important to provide us with a livelihood, to give us other important things that we need to survive. We need to be able to buy drugs, we need to access education, etc. So money is important for all those reasons, but it's not the only thing that drives production. Maybe I could give an example.
Yeah, please.
That could help clarify this. So I talk about Ethiopian coffee farmers who have suffered greatly with the fall of commodity coffee prices in recent years. Now, Ethiopian coffee farmers should not actually be suffering from the fall of commodity coffee pricing, because Ethiopian coffee is recognized as the world's best coffee. It's often called black gold. And Ethiopia is actually the birthplace of coffee, where legend has it that a shepherd boy first saw some goats who were dancing in the field from eating this peculiar plant, and then the boy himself partook of the plant and started dancing with the goats, and we found coffee. So it's considered one of the best coffees, if not the best coffee in the world, and yet their farmers were being paid commodity prices and sometimes even below that for their coffee. And so what happened in 2005 is Getachew Mengistu, the head of the Intellectual Property Office in Ethiopia, he came to the United States, and he saw that coffee from his country was selling for $26 a pound in Starbucks, and yet his own countrymen were only getting like cents for the production of the same amount of coffee. And what he did was he embarked on this really interesting, bold strategy of trademarking. He applied for trademarks in the names of Ethiopian specialty coffees, Harar, Yirgacheffe, Sidamo, around the world. And most countries' trademark offices granted these trademarks. Why did he go for trademarks? Well, because the idea was that of that $26, how much of that value should the Ethiopians be getting back? And well, one problem is they were getting back a commodity price as opposed to the recognition of the specialty coffee that they were selling. So there was that. But there was also the idea that if they could control the brand value of Harar and Yirgacheffe and Sidamo, that's really where the money is. And this again goes to this idea of today in the knowledge economy. It's the ownership of the brand, the trademark, not just the good itself, not just the raw material or the coffee beans. That is where the value is. And so this was an example of a developing country seeking to cash in on that economy and learn the secrets of Madison Avenue. How do we brand? How do we create recognition of the importance of Ethiopian coffee, the value, and not just the value in the sense of taste or quality that way, but the story of Ethiopian coffee. And this is interesting because what happened was most countries agreed to the trademark application, but Starbucks fought back and tried to oppose the applications in the U.S. Hmm. And the irony is that Starbucks doesn't sell coffee. Starbucks sells a brand, and the brand is about an experience. It's the experience of drinking exotic coffees from all of these global locales. And Starbucks had control of the story, and they didn't want these Ethiopian farmers to take control of their own story about, okay, what is Ethiopian coffee about? It's about dancing goats. It's about the history. It's about the discovery of coffee. And it's about people and fair trade and global connections and relations. So this is really what's at stake in the economy today. Who controls these stories? Who can profit from them and earn a decent livelihood from them? Starbucks opposed the Ethiopian coffee farmers, even though the country was facing famine-like conditions. And ultimately, Oxfam International, which focuses on combating hunger around the world, Oxfam ultimately got involved on the side of the Ethiopian coffee farmers to help them promote their trademark strategy and to fight Starbucks. And Starbucks ultimately was shamed into backing down. But the story is very important because it illustrates that, yes, absolutely, livelihood is extremely important when we talk about who gets to own and control intellectual property rights in our global economy, and that livelihood is connected to combating hunger, accessing education, living a good life. That's the subtitle of my book. You know, we need to think about how these rights go well beyond just incentivizing the production of more and more goods, but how can IP actually promote the ability of people to live a good life?
We're chatting with Professor Madhavi Sundar of UC Davis, author of the book From Goods to a Good Life on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU-FM, a non-commercial, non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation at KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can click on Donate to KZSU on our webpage. And indeed, if you want to underwrite Hearsay Culture, you could do that as a thought. Regardless, though, I hope you, in regards to whether you make a donation, I hope that you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture and to KZSU. You know, Madhavi, you know, getting to this point that you've been making about involving as many people as possible. One of the issues and ways that you address this is by identifying three central features of your third theory of culture, and two of them you've gotten into a bit of detail on, I think. The three central features that you identify being participation, livelihood, and shared meaning. I think, although you could correct me if I'm wrong, that you've talked a bit about participation and livelihood, but I'm curious about this idea of shared meaning, because as the example that you use with the Ethiopian coffee farmers indicates, there are very different meanings that one could take from the experience of drinking coffee, for example, or from coffee itself. So I'm curious, and again, I don't want you to not define participation and livelihood if you think that you haven't, but particularly shared meaning. What do these ideas, these features mean to you?
Sure. Well, I'd love to talk a little bit more about shared meaning, and I think the coffee example is great. I mean, every morning when we stop by, we in the West, you know, I do it. I stop by Starbucks or my local coffee shop and spend my $3 on a latte. But these are opportunities that remind us of how we are globally linked to others, Many people, when they buy that coffee, are thinking about who produced it. Fair trade is extremely important to many people, just as now consumers care about green production. They care about the fairness in the global production modes. So that's buying coffee is a way to connect to other parts of the globe and people. And so within embedded in these goods are global social relations. And this is where I think we can begin to talk about shared meaning. When the Ethiopians produce black gold, that's something the whole world enjoys and experiences together. It connects us. But we should, and I think it's readily understandable in the context of music, or dances that are shared, across cultures. I tell the story in my book of one of the most famous songs around the world, The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And this is a song that was created by a man named Solomon Linda in the 1930s in South Africa. He was living in a squalid Johannesburg hostel when he composed this haunting melody that was reminiscent of his own childhood experiences herding cattle and protecting the cattle from lions in the jungle. He wrote this song, and it was recorded. It became Africa's first hit. The record eventually crossed the Atlantic and was reborn, first as Weem Away and later as The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And it's such an incredible song. Everyone can recognize it. It was recorded 170 times over the course of the 20th century, re-recorded and remade. And of course, most famously ended up in the movie The Lion King by Disney in the 1990s, and then later in Disney's Broadway musical version of that show. But I raised this story because this song added to the wealth in millions of many people, especially Americans, but the song's composer, Solomon Linda, himself died in his 50s of a curable kidney disease with just a few dollars in his pocket and nothing, no money to his name. And it's a really important, powerful story because, one, it illustrates the importance of free culture, right? He actually created this haunting, memorable song by mixing the syncopation of American jazz that was coming from across the Atlantic with his own South African musical traditions. He mixed cultural traditions to create something totally new. So free culture is really important. And it also illustrates how we're always creating by sharing, shared meaning. And why is that song beautiful? Because the whole world knows it. I mean, I think that's really an essential part of what's so beautiful. That's what culture is. We don't have culture without shared meaning, sharing stories, sharing music, sharing films. I talk a lot. I have a whole chapter about films in the book. Mm-hmm. So sharing is fundamentally, that's the heart of culture. It's what makes it tick. And yet at the same time, we need to share on fair terms. The idea that American composers and Disney can profit in millions, and this and the song's actual composer dies destitute, is just wrong. And what is it about our global system of cultural production and exchange that has allowed for that? And so I take that issue on quite a bit. I talk about how we need to have not just free culture, but also fair culture. And we need to recognize global participants in our in creating our shared culture, whether that shared meaning comes from the coffee we drink and the stories in the cup, or if it comes from the music we enjoy, or literature, or film, what have you.
Yeah, this broad issue of participation is one that I do want to spend a couple minutes on, and we're getting close to, Madhavi, what I call the unfair portion of the show, when I ask questions that can't be answered adequately in the time that we have left. So we increasingly become a more traditional radio program as a result. But I do want to talk to you about this idea of participation, because something that I spent a good amount of time on, and I certainly have spent a lot of time on in the last year plus, is the public's inability to participate in the creation of Trans-Pacific Partnership. partnership agreement, currently being negotiated, as you know, largely in secret. And this idea of participation is one that I don't think that IP law itself has conceived much at all. Certainly the idea of encouraging the creation of goods is one that's there, but as you've pointed out, the participation of all is something that we seem to have moved outside of IP to get to. Ideas like open source, which has brought up the radical notion that perhaps people are going to create simply because they want to be part of creating something, as opposed to making money. And so I do want to ask you this question. It's ultimately a larger question, I think, about IP law generally as opposed to your theory, but I'm curious to get your thoughts. Are we asking IP law to do too much work in achieving all of these goals? In other words, can IP law simultaneously not only meet your goals, like not only creating more goods, but a greater variety of goods, and also involving more people, and also have the economic incentives in place and so forth? So I guess my question boils down to this. Are we asking too much of IP law?
I mean, I don't want to make it sound like IP is going to alone will change the world, but IP already is having a profound effect on so many aspects of what makes human development possible, what makes economic development possible in our global economy today. So, for example, I actually argue that we don't have to change many IP laws, but it's just that historically we have ignored authors. We've ignored people like Solomon Linda, who actually wrote an original work and he composed the original work and recorded it. His song was Africa's first pop hit. We have the record. And yet, by the time it came across the Atlantic, American composers called it a Zulu folklore and traditional music that didn't have a recognizable author. His name was on the record, but that's how his work got treated. And so I argue that we do need to think about dignity and respect for others, global recognition, not just having blatant ripping off in bright daylight of poor creators. So the law doesn't have to change. We just have to be fair in applying it. It's the same standard, original expression, fixed in a tangible form. That's what you need to get a recognizable copyright in the United States. But we have not historically applied that fairly, and in particular, creations by African American contributors have been ignored or appropriated unjustly. So I'm talking about kind of recognizing that, hey, there, you know, the same social problems that affect us in other walks of life affect us in the IP realm too. And so we need to be attentive to that in IP. So yes, we can achieve global justice in other fields and in other ways, but global justice is implicated in intellectual property as well. And in our domain, we need to recognize those issues and correct them, rectify them when we can.
Professor Madhavi Sundar, author of the book From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice, here on Hearsight Culture and KZSU. We have about 8 minutes left, Madhavi. I do want to ask you some of these what do we do now type questions, which again, you know, moves us in a direction of thinking seriously about your theory and applying it. And I'll ask you this question. Again, I think it ties in with what I was mentioning earlier about what I perceive as an excessive amount of secrecy in the creation of IP law. And ask this question. If this book is handed to a U.S. policymaker, and I'm not going to name names, but it winds up with a member of Congress, for example, what would you want them to take from your book? From a policymaking perspective, what would you want them to take as the overused and popular phrase in the media, the takeaway? What would be the takeaway?
Okay. Maybe I could specifically talk about the takeaway in two different fields, right? Mm-hmm. So let's think about copyright law. Copyright law, emerging aspect of participatory culture that people are actually more and more familiar with right now is fan fiction and fan activity. So participatory activity that can range from fans rewriting Star Trek stories or Harry Potter stories to today we have real world Quidditch leagues where, you know, college students, join Quidditch teams and go and compete in a global World Cup. So mm-hmm. they're running with brooms between their legs. So we have all this really interesting participatory activity around copyrighted works. And there is a live question. Is this activity legal? And I want policymakers to broaden the way we have thought about fair use. The law and economic analysis of fair use has come to be extremely narrow. Law and economic scholars argue that we only need fair use in cases of market failure. And the paradigm example of market failure would be one of parody or critique. When somebody is parodying or critiquing an existing work, like Gone with the Wind, then law and economic scholars would argue that, well, you need to have fair use there because nobody in their right mind would license the right to be made fun of. That's an instance of market failure. Therefore, you need fair use there. But in a whole host of other examples, like Quidditch leagues or fan fiction around The Hunger Games or Twilight, that in these examples, you don't need fair use because if you're paying homage to the original work, if you're just reworking the original work, there's no reason that the copyright owner or the author would refuse a license, and if they do, it's their right to do so. And you don't have an instance of market failure there, therefore, no fair use. And that's just too narrow of a way of determining whether or not people get to participate in these cultural worlds that they love and develop their autonomy, find communities for socializing and sociability, develop their critical thinking. Harry Potter is an amazing example because you've got kids around the world who are working on real-world versions of the newspapers in the Harry Potter world. They have created what's called adult real-world Dumbledore's Army, where they work together on issues like ranging from Darfur to book banning to corruption. So this is great. This fosters critical thinking. This fosters community. It's way better than just bowling together. I mean, here people are creating new works and employing their critical thinking skills together. So I would want policymakers to understand that there are all of these benefits that promote learning and democracy and sociability by engaging cultural works, not just in critical ways, but in ways that expand them and rework them. And so I think that one tangible outcome from this that I would wish for would be to have this broad understanding of the role that fair use can play in copyright law to allow for these kinds of reworkings without fear of being sent a cease and desist letter without fear of being sued. That's one example in the copyright context. In the patent context, I think that we actually have, again, we have good laws in place. So much of what I'm arguing in the book is not that we need massive legal reform, but it's how we interpret those laws and the political will to stand by the laws. So in the context of patents, although I think that it was a mistake to require 20-year patents in all World Trade Organization countries, including the least developing countries, including in the area of pharmaceutical drugs, I think this was a massive mistake. We did do it with the establishment of the WTO, but we also have provisions for compulsory licenses by countries that believe they need to break a patent and give a reasonable royalty in the interest of promoting public health, in the interest of meeting disaster scenarios or crisis situations in their countries. And in fact, some really bold countries like Brazil and Thailand have issued compulsory licenses to meet the public health needs of their people, but the American government and pharmaceutical companies have come down on those countries for simply exercising their rights under the law. And so we haven't allowed for the political will hasn't been with these countries that are using their compulsory licenses. So these are some just a couple examples where I think, again, we need to draw our attention to the fact that the laws actually, and exceptions to the laws and limitations to the laws actually do help give us some tools for promoting health, for promoting access, for promoting participation. But how we interpret those laws that exist now matters. If we choose narrow interpretations that would only allow very limited participation, that's going to have severe repercussions. And I would argue we need to have more broad interpretations and coming from various theories, not just law and economics, but from theories of human development and cultural studies as well, that would allow us to recognize why it's important to have spaces of participation, why it's important that IP rights in the patent context promote not just innovation, but also human values, the ability for people to live a good life.
Professor Madhavi Sundar, author of the book From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice, book recently come out from Yale University Press. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture and getting into these issues. I invite you back to continue the discussion. I mean, I think clearly the book is written in a way that both policymakers, IP and technology experts, as well as social theorists, I think would all find useful. As I read through your book, I was reminded and I was thinking of the work of Manuel Castells, the eminent sociologist who's written about these issues of power in the creation of not only a cultural good, but of knowledge even more broadly. And I think your work fits right in there with his work. So I thank you for joining us today on the show. I look forward to chatting with you in the future. But I think we've had a great discussion.
Thanks so much, Dave. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Let me mention a couple of guests that are coming up in the remaining few weeks of this quarter, which is rapidly coming to a close. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that during KZSU's interim, I don't record new shows, but we have a few more shows coming up, particularly Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia Law, co-author of the book The Knockoff Economy, as well as Professors Jeremy DeBeer and Chidi Ogumanum of the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law discussing the Open Air Project. I am in the process, and over the next several weeks, I'll be booking guests for the fall quarter of KZSU's calendar, which will begin towards the end of September and continue through about Thanksgiving, roughly. And so I do welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback on guests that I should have by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. In addition, you have a couple of ways that you can listen to the show. This quarter, the show has been on at 9 a.m. Tuesdays, Pacific time, on KZSU. But you can also get the show via podcast by going to either the Apple iTunes page for Stanford Center for Internet Society, where you can get all of Hearsay Culture shows as well as previous shows and indeed other events that have occurred at CIS. Or you can email me, or you can go to our webpage at hearsayculture.com or to Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So I thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you found the discussion enlightening. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming and have a great day.